As I'm sure you all know, the Foundation Lecture is Fitzwilliam's major annual public lecture. And I think most of you were given, as you came in, a piece of paper which will have told you that the first lecture in this series, when it became an annual series, was given in 1969. It was named the Centenary Lecture since Fitzwilliam House was created in 1869, marked 100 years of the founding of Fitzwilliam House. That lecture was given by Sir Ernst Chain, FRS, who was the Nobel Prize winning biochemist who had obtained his PhD as a member of Fitzwilliam House. I think there's a nice parallel between Sir Ernst Chain's work and that of Professor Balasubramanian, both engaged in discovering means for transforming what were perhaps basic or fundamental concepts into large-scale medical technologies with immense applications. And both, I stress, were students of Fitzwilliam. Alumni are often surprised to learn that we keep their files, and one of the pleasures of being master is every now and then you snoop in people's files. So this week I have read Shanker's supervision reports. There were, I'm sorry to say, no surprises there. He was consistently described as being relaxed and in control of his studies. He didn't struggle with his work. He appeared to shine somewhat effortlessly. Interpret that as you will. I think it was definitely a compliment. He was also not only a great footballer in college, but also, and here I quote from a reference, a partner in a promotions agency which arranged large-scale entertainment in Cambridge and in London. Then as a graduate student here, he wrote a very persuasive letter that he needed to have a telephone in his room, not only because of his active role in GEMA, the group to encourage ethnic minority applications, but also because of his role as a graduate union disc jockey. So he knew how to play as well as being very successful, and I think there's a very good message for current students there. You can do lots of things and do very well in your studies. So Shanker came here to Fitzwilliam in 1985. Brian Johnson was his director of studies. He stayed on here to do his PhD under Professor Chris Abel before going to Penn State University for postdoctoral work. He returned to Cambridge in 1994 and climbed the academic pole swiftly, and perhaps the supervision reports don't continue to tell us whether it was still effortlessly, convincingly, in that he was elected in 2008 as the Herschel Smith Professor of Medicinal Chemistry. And interestingly, I think he holds joint appointments between the clinical school and the Department of Chemistry, directing research labs in the Department of Chemistry and also at the Cancer Research UK Cambridge Institute at the Adam Brooks Biomedical Campus. As I'm sure you all know, because it's why you're here, he was the co-inventor of the leading method for decoding DNA, thus transforming the extremely expensive and slow decoding of the human genome into, as I understand it, a routine, accurate, low-cost process. It is with enormous pleasure that I welcome him here tonight to talk to us about decoding human genomes on a population scale.
Thank you very much, Nikki. You've reminded me of some things from the past. It's a great honor to be here. I should say that The telephone request was successful. I did have a telephone in my room. So for any Fitzwilliam students here, if you want a telephone and you need some advice on how to get one, you know where to find me. I had many, many happy years here, six happy years as a student, and it's a pleasure to see some of my former teachers in the audience here. I'm going to tell you something that's turning into a Cambridge story, and it's about DNA. I'm a chemist, I'm an organic chemist, but I've always been interested in DNA. I know some of you here are non-scientists, so I'm going to just brush up on some basics for you. So this is a molecule of DNA, a double helix. And the reason why it's particularly interesting is because the four canonical letters of DNA, G, C, T, and A, they recognize each other in a very special way. C recognizes G through this Watson-Crick base pairing, and T recognizes A. And this code, this molecular recognition code, is buried in the interior stack of the DNA double helix. And this is the basis for the code of genetics, the code of life. Now, this lecture is going to be about reading the code of DNA. And I thought it would be of interest to give you a little bit of history on decoding DNA. And again, there's a lot of Cambridge history here. So in 1952, this is a paper that was published by Alex Todd, who was the professor of organic chemistry at that time, and Dan Brown, who some of you will know. It's published in 1952. This is a year before the Watson-Crick paper on the double helix. And it was at a time, really, when chemists had spent decades elucidating the chemical structure of DNA and RNA with great precision. And in fact, Todd's contribution was defining the chemical structure of RNA. That was one of his major contributions to the field. But in 52, chemists at that time liked to solve chemical structures, and they did so by organic synthesis and analytical methods. And they made this statement: there can be no question of finality about any nucleic acid structure at the present time, since it is clear there is no available method for determining the nucleotide sequence. There was no method to read the code. And in fact, in 1953, Todd and Brown published a paper that was the earliest method I'm aware of a chemistry for decoding a nucleic acid. It was a chemistry for decoding RNA. And I think it was a little ahead of its time, because the molecular biology revolution had not yet happened. We didn't really understand the role of RNA. But that's the earliest trace of a method for decoding DNA and RNA. The method that really took over the world in the late 1970s was the method of Fred Sanger. Now, yesterday marked, it was a year ago yesterday that we lost this great Cambridge scientist, Fred Sanger. And in 1977, he published a method I won't spell out in fine detail, but it was an elegant method for reading a sequence of DNA by using part of nature's machines for synthesizing DNA. And he had a clever trick that could lead to the synthesis being stopped at either A or G or C or T. So when you used a method to separate the fragments of DNA that were partially stopped at each of these four bases, you could separate them, and based on their size, you could read the code A, G, T, T, G, C, T, A in this case. There was another method in the other Cambridge at Harvard from Gilbert and Maxim that was also elegant, but actually this is the method that prevailed. And in fact, this is the method that was used to sequence the first human genome in the International Human Genome Project. So a wonderful method from a brilliant mind, Fred Sanger. Now, I started my academic research, my independent research, in 1994. That's when I came back to Cambridge. And one of the first things I did was write a proposal for an idea with a colleague, David Kleneman, who I'll introduce you to in a moment. And this was to the Research Council, the BBSRC, to use taxpayers' money to explore something where we had no idea what was going to happen. Now, the two characters who did this is Colin Barnes and Mark Osborne. These were postdocs in our lab. And here's what we proposed to do. We proposed to take a piece of glass and immobilize one molecule, just one molecule of DNA to the surface. Build an instrument called a confocal fluorescence microscope that could visualize fluorophores, but an instrument that could visualize just one fluorophore. It was so sensitive you could detect single molecules. And what we wanted to do was watch nature's machines called polymerases, DNA polymerases, synthesize DNA and see what we could learn. That was the essence of the proposal. And because it was 1995, they funded it. Remarkable. I should stress, nowhere in that proposal did we mention the word sequencing. That was not what we were going to do. Now, I've challenged this organization and said no way would they fund that same proposal today. And I think that's a correct statement. Now, the way that we did this is we were watching building blocks go into this growing strand of DNA one at a time by attaching a fluorescent dye to it so that we could image it as it goes in. And that is what we did. Now, this is not the Fitzwilliam Bar, but I enjoyed many moments like this in the Fitzwilliam Bar as a student. This is to introduce David Kleneman, a physical chemist, a laser spectroscopist, whom I met very early on. He started the same time as me. And some of you may know this place. It's near the chemistry department. And in 1994, when I was just new in the department, actually I didn't have an office for a while. Actually didn't have a lab for a while. I was starting from scratch. And so if I wanted to chat to someone, I used to go here quite often. It was nice. And I have to say, once I became a professor, I got this nice big office. And I don't go there anymore. So I've discovered this new equation that the amount of time I spend in a pub is inversely proportional to the area of my office. And it makes very infrequent visits at the moment. Now, we used to go here and talk about ideas, and it was here that we started seeing that what we were in fact doing could be adapted to read the sequence of a strand of DNA. And this is a very old slide, and in essence it defines what became Solexa sequencing. If you immobilize one molecule of DNA to part of a surface, and you can attach fluorescent dyes to the building blocks that are used to synthesize DNA, so that the color actually tells you the letter. So green is for C, blue is for G, and so forth. If you can persuade nature's machines to put in these now slightly altered building blocks, What these machines do is amazing. They synthesize a piece of DNA using another strand as a template. So this machine knows to put an A opposite a T, and then a T opposite an A, and then a C opposite a G, and so forth. And they do so with exquisite accuracy. Otherwise, our genomes would be changing all the time. This is what happens every time a cell divides. These machines copy the DNA with amazing accuracy. Now, if one could do this, whereby you incorporate just one, and it brings its dye with it, and you can somehow stop the reaction, and image the surface, you will see a red color go in when an A base is inserted. And so you read that and you retrieve one unit of information from the code. Now, if you could somehow then use chemistry to remove that dye, that red dye, and remove whatever was preventing the second building block from going in, you would end up going to here, which is this situation extended by one unit. And then you could go and do another cycle and watch the next building block go in. And in this fashion, you would, in steps, build the strand of DNA, and at each step, you could look at the color that's been incorporated, and you could decode the sequence. Okay, this is the essence of the idea. Now, why would we do this? Fred Sanger had invented a beautiful method that had been optimized and automated. So we'd heard about the Human Genome Project, and it was taking place nearby at the institute named after Fred Sanger, the Sanger Institute. So we, one afternoon, we drove out to the Sanger, and we met three of the founders of the Human Genome Project. And we had three questions. One, how's it going? Two, will this project definitely come to a completion? Will there be a human genome reference sequence? And three, that's only one genome. How are you going to sequence? We're all different. How are you going to sequence all these genomes if it takes 10 years and all this money to do one? So we told them our idea, and they were very excited. They gave us all the reality check to know that if we could reduce this to practice, it could be interesting, it could be useful. So that was a key moment. Now, what I'm going to do is tell you a little bit, not too much detail, a little bit about the mechanics of how it works. And then I'm going to tell you about what it does. Here's a strand of DNA called a template, and here's a primer. This is the part of the DNA that's going to be extended using the template as a guide. Now, in nature, these machines are amazing. What they do is that they catalyze a reaction where a building block comes in. I won't go into the fine chemical detail, but this oxygen at the end here, you see, this acts as what chemists call a nucleophile. This oxygen attacks the monomer, causes a reaction that leads to a bond forming from here to the next base, which in this case would be an A opposite a T. And we had to adapt nature's method into a method for sequencing. And there are two things we had to do. We had to attach this red dye. I've not given its molecular structure, but it's a fairly complex structure. We had to attach it to each of the bases, G, C, T, and A. And there's a way of engineering these building blocks so that you attach the dye without tinkering with the part of the base that is involved in the Watson-Crick base pairing. If you interfere with that, you can spoil the code. So we have to preserve that coding function. And we attach a dye. And the other thing we do are that oxygen that forms a bond to the next building block after each cycle. We have to block that with a protecting group, so that one of these goes in and it stops at exactly one and allows us to read and decode what's gone in. I know there are some organic chemists here, so this slide is for you. For others, please bear with me for one slide. This is what the first generation sequencing nucleotides looked like. And the unnatural features are here and actually here. Now, this is a special chemical group called an azide. And if I took away these two atoms and attached an azide here, that's a bit like the drug AZT, the anti-HIV drug, has an azide. That's what the A stands for. And we have a similar functionality here. And we chose this because there's some beautiful chemistry from almost 100 years ago, invented by a German chemist called Hermann Staudinger, that allows you in water very mildly to reduce azides. And when you reduce this azide and this azide in water, it leads to a cleavage of the part that you no longer need to do the next cycle. So this chemistry was very, very important. Okay, so I've now described how you can decode a piece of DNA that's been fixed to a surface by reading bases one step at a time by a sequence of fluorescent dyes. That in itself doesn't get you anywhere. However, the ability to decode DNA that's fixed to a surface lends itself to the idea of fixing lots of DNA molecules to a fairly small surface and then imaging them and reading them all collectively at the same time. So this is parallelization. And as you know, in the microelectronics industry, the capacity to use smaller components and parallelize in smaller spaces has led to massive increases in computational power. So here was our idea, and this is pretty much how it's used today. Here is a cell with some DNA, and you can extract the DNA, and you can fragment it into small pieces. You can do this mechanically. Now, if we dilute this and then literally splash this solution onto a surface and use some chemistry to capture each of these fragments, what you will do is you'll form an array of DNA molecules on the surface where you have single fragments, each sitting in its own optically resolvable space. So we call this a single molecule array. Now, the idea here is a simple way of forming an array of DNA molecules, which we can then decode using the chemistry I just described. It's definitely for you, Nikki. Right. Okay, so you form a single molecule array. Now, I'm going to introduce you to one step that we borrowed from these guys, Kawashima et al. In Switzerland. So I was not involved in inventing this. This was their invention. And it was adapted by Illumina. So we take a piece of DNA fragment. You can use standard molecular biology to top and tail this fragment with known sequences that are synthetic. You can then take a surface of a microfluidic cell, as it is now, with complementary pieces of blue and red DNA. And when you flow these fragments in, they stick to the surface. Now, this is a little bit of molecular biology here. The red complements the red and combined. And what you can do is use a polymerase and building blocks, and you can amplify one molecule of DNA into lots of copies that are identical in sequence. But you can do so in a way that involves one end of the DNA always being anchored to the surface. So they don't diffuse away, they stay clustered. Now, this was a nice method because we turn one molecule into lots of copies that all stay in the same place. And you can use the fluorescent sequencing method to decode each of these clusters. Now, why did we do this? We did this for two reasons. One, you get a brighter signal from lots of molecules, so you can use a cheaper camera. So by now we were thinking of, we had started a company called Selexa to turn this into something real. And rather than selling really expensive instruments that no one could afford, it had to be practical. That was one reason. The other reason is, if you watch one molecule do changes in bases, there are stochastic errors that are generated by single molecule physics. And by having lots of votes for each base core, you iron out these errors and you get much greater accuracy. Okay, so that's why we did this. Now, this is some data from the very first genome we sequenced using this method. It was done in 2005, so by now we'd set up a company called Selexa in 1998 to really integrate all the parts needed to reduce this into a system. And we sequenced a small genome of bacteriophage called PhyX174. This is an expansion just to show you these little circles being imaged. Now, each one of these circles represents hundreds of copies of a single molecule DNA fragment that entered into this flow cell. And the colors represent whether you have G, C, T, or A being read at each cluster of DNA molecules in a given cycle. And what would happen in the next cycle is these colors may change depending on what the next base in the sequence of that DNA fragment is. Okay, so this is real data, and you can see each of these features is about a micron. So we're working quite close to the diffraction limit of light. Now, the beauty of this is on a square centimeter, you can pack in millions and millions of different DNA molecules, and you can decode them all at the same time. Now, the reason we were keen to know if this human genome project would be completed was that we were in effect proposing to take DNA, which one copy of a human genome is about 3 billion bases, fragment it into smaller pieces that were hundreds of bases in size, and then read a short sequence without knowing where it came from, and then somehow make sense of that data in relation to the human genome. And with a lot of help from Richard Durbin, a bioinformatician from the Sanger Institute, we calculated that if you could read 25 bases of a randomly generated fragment, and you had one or two unknown mutations or base changes, that we could realign this to the human genome reference sequence that comes out of the Human Genome Project and cover most of the genome, and then call all the differences. Now, today, actually, the chemistry works so well that we're able to read actually a couple of hundred bases quite easily. And what works in practice is that you have a fragment, you don't know where it came from, you read 150, if you want, you can read 250 from one end and from the other end. And you do this on gazillions of fragments of DNA. And then you use computation to line them all up against the master sequence from the Human Genome Project. And because you have such high sequencing capacity, every base in the genome gets called more than once from different fragments. So you line them all up, and you can read what the bases are at each site, and you can see if there are any changes from the reference sequence. So you can use this to detect all the genetic variation in a population of humans. I have to say, this concept is one of a number of concepts where much of the world told us it would never work in 1998, and they were wrong, because we used it and published a human genome using this method several years later. Okay, so I mentioned Solexa. David Kleneman and I formed a company called Solexa with the university in 1998. And by 2006, this was announced in early 2007, by 2006, one of these systems, just one, could sequence a billion bases of DNA in one experiment. Now, it took a while. It took about 4 weeks, actually. You pushed a button and hoped there were no power cuts or... But it was a single experiment, and that was a landmark. It was a landmark because that capacity from one box represented the whole global sequencing capacity as it was in 1998 when we started. And you could do it in one box. Now, this generated so much excitement that a company called Illumina in the US acquired this technology and acquired Solexa and continued to make it go faster and better. And I'm still involved with Illumina, I should say, and I've been delighted to continue to participate on improving the chemistry, but also a lot of improvements in engineering, I should say. And in 2011, they released a slightly more stylish looking instrument. And this instrument could, in a single experiment, well, today it routinely does a trillion bases of DNA in one experiment. And that takes just a few days, it's less than a week. So one of these has, depending on how you want to look at it, a capacity greater than the global capacity as it was in 2007, or 1,000 times more than the global capacity in 1998. And anyone can buy one. So in this period of time, in terms of capacity, the improvement has actually been about a millionfold in a little over a decade. And the cost is important. The Human Genome Project costs somewhere between $300 million and $3 billion, depending on who your accountant is. But I'm going to take an order of magnitude figure of $1 billion. Today, it is factually correct that you can accurately sequence a whole human genome for just below $1,000 US. So there's a cost change. The economics has changed by a millionfold. One of my favorite genomes was the giant panda genome that was sequenced by the Beijing Genome Institute, published in 2008. This is just to remind me that it's egocentric to talk about human genomes. There are lots of very interesting genomes in the world of other animals, organisms, plants. And there are some wonderful explorations to decode the genomes of exotic and rare organisms. I should say it also works for paleontologists. You can extract DNA from the woolly mammoth or Neanderthal man and so forth, so, and regenerate with quite high accuracy what the genomes of these now extinct organisms look like. So there's an area there that's opened up, basic research. Now I'm going to return to human genomes, which is the main theme of today, and just finish off by telling you a little bit about what's happened with human genomes and where it might be going. Now this marked the first draft Human Genome Project sequence, 2001. Before 2008, there were just three human genomes deposited. I was involved with one of the genomes in this. So there were three human genomes in this edition of Nature. The first African genome, I was involved with that project. The first Asian genome, and the first genome of a cancer. And that doubled the number of human genomes from 3 to 6. Today, there are over 250,000 human genomes that have been sequenced in total. And one of the main drivers is whether understanding intrinsic and induced genetic variation can help us learn something about how to do medicine better than we are doing. Now I'm going to give you a few examples, published examples, work done by other people, as a taster of what's possible and what's being explored. Cancer is fundamentally a genetic disease. It is caused by alterations in a genome. And so it is fundamental to cancer genomes and understanding cancer genomes to decode them and see how they have changed from the parent genome. Now there was a wonderful paper published in 2010 by a group in Vancouver, a cancer genetics group involving a physician and a patient. And this was at a time when it took 4 weeks to sequence a genome, so it was not a short project. And what they did is that they had a patient who had cancer of the tongue and was treated with standard of care chemotherapy. And as often happens, the cancer metastasized and became resistant to the drug. It changed. And it metastasized the lung. So they took lung aspirates, because the physicians tried every combination of medication that was reasonable on the basis of symptoms, and nothing worked. And they sequenced the primary tumor, the metastatic tumor, and they sequenced the normal DNA from this patient. They also sequenced all the RNA in these three cases, and they analyzed it. Now, what's shown here is an example of a metabolic pathway that's key to cancer. And often in cancers, there is a dominant pathway that drives the proliferation of the tumor. And when they looked at this metastatic tumor, what they found is that some genes had amplified. There were more copies than there should be of some genes. And as a result, the activity of that gene function goes up to higher than normal. And they also find some genes were deleted. They were no longer present and therefore not functional. Now, the initial drug that they were using was targeting this pathway, and the data explained why that no longer worked. But they also saw another pathway lit up by these genetic changes in the metastatic tumor, and saw this gene here as a culprit. Fortunately, there was already an approved drug to target the receptor encoded by this gene, RET. So they applied that drug, and they were able to control the tumor for another 3 months. And then it metastasized again, unfortunately. And they carried out the same analysis. They found another pathway. They chose a drug to block that pathway, and it controlled the tumor for a while. Now, ultimately, sadly, this patient died. But in this paper, what they describe is the learning that comes from watching the evolution of a cancer genome in response to a certain drug. And what they conclude is, if they had known at the beginning what they knew at the end, they would have prescribed these three drugs in combination at the same time. And this mirrors the evolution of the anti-HIV triple drug regime. It's blocking emergent pathways before they emerge. And a lot of research going on at the Sanger, led by Mike Stratton and his colleagues, is actually looking at understanding whether there are common pathways, genetic evolution of cancers, that could teach us more about how to manage them. Now, this is a Cambridge story, actually. It comes from Addenbrookes, where there was a meticillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus outbreak a few years ago. Now, this is a pathogen for which there is only one antibiotic that works, vancomycin. And there is this worry that if it acquires vancomycin resistance, then it'll be untreatable. And we could have an epidemic on our hands. So in a neonatal ward, there was a recurrence of methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. This work was led by Sharon Peacock. And they couldn't get rid of it. So what they did is that they rapidly decoded the genome of this pathogen. And they found that it was a completely new variant that had never been seen before. So in fact, it was an outbreak, technically. They were also able to trace exactly where it came from. And it came from one of the nursing staff who was popping in and out of the ward, which is why, over a period of many months, it kept recurring. And they were able to wipe it out and prevent it from being an outbreak. Now, the last area I'm going to talk about relates to what are called rare genetic diseases. There are a class of diseases called rare genetic diseases. Many of them don't have names, are ill described, it's not clear how to treat them or diagnose them. But one in 17 of us has a rare genetic disease. One in 17. So collectively, they are not rare. They are mainly genetic in causation. And most of them manifest very early in life, the developmental disorders. So this is what the pediatricians have to deal with. And in fact, there is a Cambridge-based project sequencing rare diseases going on. Now, a lot of this happens in pediatric wards and neonatal wards. And I'm going to tell this is, again, a real anecdote. From a place run by Stephen Kingsmore, and this is one of a number of very pioneering clinics in the US. So a child presents at 5 months with developmental disorders, and typically what happens in this case is the parents have to go through a long and painful series of diagnostic tests, which are expensive and time-consuming, and often end up telling you what your child does not have. And it can run up a tab of up to $100,000 to tell you what isn't going on. And what they do in this clinic, in cases that look like that, they sequence the genomes of both parents and the child. It's called a trio. And they do rapid comparative analysis. Now, this is a case of a child. The DNA was actually sent over here to Cambridge, to Illumina Cambridge, and they sequenced it. They sent it back, after interpreting it, so they triaged it, applied various filters, and they got to the bottom of it. They found what the genetic cause was. And they confirmed a diagnosis of Menkes disease, which is a copper metabolism disorder that's treatable, I should say. Now, this was all done in 4 days, including shipping the samples across from the US to Cambridge and sending the data back and the sequencing in 4 days. Now, this chap, Stephen Kingsmore, he has two of these sequences in his clinic, and he describes them as ambulances. He says, there must always be one waiting in case a child walks in and this needs to be done and the other one's occupied. So this is real. I'm going to end with this slide. This is this was sent to me from the iPhone of the CEO of Illumina, Jay Flatley, on August the 1st. Don't look at Alex Salmond or Barack Obama. What took the headline here was this thing in the middle, and it's I think a truly pioneering move by the UK involving the NHS. So our Prime Minister almost 2 years ago vowed to launch a project that involved patients, physicians, the NHS, and genome sequencing, mainly targeting infectious diseases, cancer, and rare genetic diseases, to sequence 100,000 patients with their full clinical histories in order to see whether there were cases that could be immediately helped, and I think equally importantly, start the process of learning to understand what might be truly possible by applying these principles to medicine. And I think we have to wait and see over the next 10 years what the limitations are and what is truly possible to do routinely. Now, I want to end with some acknowledgements. David Kleinerman was my sort of the co-inventor and co-founder of this. So I none of this would have happened without him and me, both of us. These guys were in our lab in Lensfield Road at the very beginning. And perhaps a mixture of naivety and enthusiasm, we gave them a little challenge, a little project to do. And they worked on it at a time when I think it could have been viewed as utter madness trying to do this. And I want to acknowledge their vision and enthusiasm. Very many people in this company, Celexa, that was founded in Cambridge in 1998, for reducing this to practice in a robust system that other people could use. We could never have done that in the university. And then Illumina, who acquired this technology, have done wonderful things to improve it, and so very many brilliant scientists in Illumina. I'll stop there. Thank you.